It's Friday, it's a Squawker Talker podcast. We're back in the room with Nick English and James Benj from the London Evening Standard. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well, how are you?
I'm not bad. It's a nice warm day.
It's actually ridiculously hot.
A nice warm podcast room, which will make this a short one. How are you, Nick?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm not bad. Warm. Are you warm?
I'm not, actually, I'm fine.
We're going to have some hot takes. It's good. The temperature is going to rise in here as we move on to... Since James is with us, you are Arsenal correspondent for the London Evening Standard, as well as many other things. Arsene Wenger, he's staying. Maybe a good thing to start on before we get onto the Champions League final, which we will shortly.
Two more years.
The right decision from you?
Like everyone that follows this club kind of day in, day out, you kind of and ah over it. But then I think when it comes down to it, Arsenal were in no way ready to move on from Arsene Wenger. It would have been an absolute disaster of a summer.
Ross and Rachel, innit?
It is, isn't it? I don't know what happened eventually on that, what happened when they spun off onto Joey, if they did it all get together. But I think, two more years and it could be more. That's the one thing I'd say. It's not necessarily like 2019 is the end point. We could be going a fair while yet.
This might be an obvious thing to ask, but what does he have to do to make it all worthwhile?
Win the Premier League?
Win the league.
Or the champ. I think the champ. You can get away with not winning the Premier League if you win the Champions League. That one's a bit.
That's kind of like I'll have a silver golden toilet seat if my platinum one's not available.
Winning the league is the only thing that's gonna appease the Wenger out brigade.
But how do you rate Arsenal's chances to win either the league or the Champions League within the next 2 years, or maybe longer?
Well, low, because the Premier League's the most competitive it's ever been, arguably. The amount of money that all of these teams can spend, Spurs are now a well-established force with lots. They can spend lots and lots of money. Okay, they're going to have stadium debt for a while, but they can attract players. Pochettino's an exciting coach. He obviously wants to stay and build a project. Klopp's got a lot going for him at Liverpool. He's still not spent any money. Big money, Klopp. That's one of the worrying things for other clubs. Pep, Man City's building like crazy.
They're going to sign two squads, aren't they?
They're going to sign two squads, all really, really young. Man United, Jose Mourinho's got a blank check every summer. And Chelsea, they've got crap loads of money, a really good first 11, and a really good coach. So, for Arsenal to win the league, it's going to be very, very difficult. But, Wenger's been in this position before where he's sort of the odds have been against him. Take a look at me now. And, he's conjured up something out of nowhere. So if anyone can in that sort of position without spending a ridiculous amount of money, it's probably him. But it's a huge ask at this point.
It's harder than it's ever been. Yeah. And the reality is we know that Arsenal aren't the sort of paupers they were when they moved into the Emirates Stadium. But, he's been given £100 million to spend on new players this summer.
It's weird how that doesn't sound like a lot now,
though. It's nothing. He can get more. He can sell off a few players. I would imagine he'll get kind of £15 million for Lucas Perez, £5 million for Ospina. He's got to clear a lot of the wage bill as well, those two, Debuchy.
I was going to say, speaking of blank checks, fortunately the goalkeeping situation seems to sort itself out. Petacek's kind of got his form sorted now. He's back to the player he kind of looked like he was moving away from again.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, you run through that Arsenal starting 11, and it's not like it can't win. That squad can win the league. And I think that's what's so frustrating for Arsenal supporters and Arsenal's board and Wenger and Sanchez and everyone, is that squad is clearly capable of winning the league. I think you can make a convincing argument that it's a better squad than Chelsea. Maybe it needs an improvement in midfield. Maybe it needs one more centre-back. It definitely needs a really top-quality striker. But
just on that point, though, you said they got £100 million to spend. Haven't they just put £100 million bid in for Mbappe?
€100 million.
It's not close. Far off.
They have pocket change for the rest of the squad.
Exactly. And the reports already are that bid has been rejected by Monaco. I know that Arsenal are huge fans of Mbappe. I think they can get him. I think they know that it's kind of getting a player who won't be there forever, because he is, he's probably too good to stay at Arsenal forever. But Arsenal can offer Mbappe the chance to be the star man, to wear the number 9 shirt, to not be coming off the bench to replace Benzema or to replace Suarez. And I think they think that might swing it. I'm not sure I buy it. I think Lacazette could be the one they end up with. I don't know if he pushes them over the edge. It's so difficult to know with someone like Lacazette because it's all your whole evidence base is in France.
The issue with Lacazette is that, as Jean-Michel Aulas, the president of Lyon, said last night, is that the whole Atletico transfer ban has massively complicated things because Lacazette is desperate to go to Atletico and work under Simeone.
But you would, I mean, you look at their list of strikers that have come through that club and become world-class.
Yeah, I mean, Lacazette looks at it and thinks, that is the club for me, that I am perfect. And he's absolutely right. And he has a fellow Frenchman there in Gamero, and he would even be happy to play alongside Griezmann, but now that deal's really complicated, and Aulas is known as for holding out on transfer fees like crazy. And already Man City have set the bar with transfer fees this summer by spending a huge amount of money on Bernardo Silva, so it doesn't look like it's going to abate from last summer. But I do understand Wenger. I do think that actually going for one massive marquee player is the right way to go, because Arsenal's squad depth is probably the best in the league. You look at, even in the FA Cup final, you know, Monreal, Mertesacker and Holding, okay, not like world class or maybe even top class, but those are three very competent defenders who have performed well at...
It's not a bad second line.
It's not
it?
A bad second line of defence, you know, and that's sort of the thing that you're looking at. And then up front you've got Welbeck, Perez, Giroud, Sanchez can play there, Walcott can sort of play there. So they've got a lot of depth as a club. So adding star quality is definitely what's required.
But we have had a question on that, but before we come on to it, I want to ask you, James, what is the state of the boardroom now? There was some talk that there was actually a split between almost like the Gazidis camp and the Wenger camp, some wanting more of a kind of structure in place, some wanting...
The Wenger bus.
The Wenger bus, sorry, and it's jumping and everybody's, you know how it goes. What do you make of it? Where do you think the loyalties and agendas lie now?
So it seems quite clear that there were certain board members by the end that were wondering if... I would say they were only wondering if another contract was the right move for Arsene. I think, as he himself said, the kind of final weeks of the season really made his case for him and I think pushed him over the edge. The reality is Arsene Wenger reports to Stan Kroenke, and while he has Stan Kroenke's backing, there's not really any issue. He will manage as long as he wants. Ivan Gazidis made great pains of sort of saying, you know, you don't sack world-class managers. But then, he's been talking at length about being a sort of catalyst for change, and none of that seems to be happening. There won't be a director of football. There might be someone at a lower level who helps with scouting. But it's also that Wenger kind of has used so many chances in the press to be a little bit snooty about what Gazidis brings. He's been really kind of quite dismissive of analytics, of the director of football, all these things that Gazidis wants. I think they'll kind of soldier on. But I think, you know, if this was a power struggle, Gazidis has been absolutely hammered.
He's been thrown into the ground. I mean, also the fact that Wenger's talking about another, like potentially another 2-year deal in the future means that this isn't going to be a handover period, because that's what was lacking this summer, is that if you look at it from a board point of view, it's like, we're not ready to hand over to a different manager. The whole setup is so... Wenger's not ready to... There needs to be a whole...
Kind of pushing the problem on, aren't they, rather than actually thinking about how to use this time to solve it.
Yeah, exactly.
They'll try and do some of it. But the challenge is, if you believe that Arsenal is a club that will benefit from a director of football, you won't get that under Wenger, so you will have to appoint that as soon as he leaves. But, I mean, you know, sort of... Again, you can't call it a sporting director, but like a head of scouting. Yeah. The other thing is they've got to hire a head of youth development as well. Andrus Jonker's left.
And he,
I remember goalkeeping coach.
Some fans were saying he was almost like a person coming to the club to take control of that part of the team.
He was almost
Wenger to delegate, and now that's gone.
Yeah, he didn't necessarily have the greatest relationship with Wenger by all accounts, so... It certainly seems like Wenger's kind of won a bit of a power struggle, maybe. We shall see.
Another fan theory I've seen floating around the internet, as you often see, is the idea that Granit Xhaka and maybe Lucas Perez weren't Wenger signings. And if you go back to his press conferences early in the season, Wenger saying, oh, he's a box-to-box midfielder, he's a deep-line playmaker, didn't seem to be sure what he was. And the suggestion is that he was a Gazidis signing. Is anything in that?
There's nothing in that. Arsene Wenger, there's no Arsenal signings that aren't Wenger signings. There might be some that, like, he's not that... he's not that come from other sources initially, but Arsene Wenger has the final sign off on all players. He really likes Granit Xhaka. The fact of the matter is, it was he spoke in similar way. Arsenal fans seem to forget he spoke in similar ways about Robert Pires, and Robert Pires had similar issues. It takes a while in a new league to find out what you're best at and to find the system that works for you. I mean,
he's not averse to tough love, Wenger. You remember how when Van Persie joined Arsenal, he was. you know, he was very, very reluctant to give him like a steadfast run in the team. And then Van Persie had all those injuries, and he was sort of like preferring Adebayor over him for a while. So he's not averse to it. And it was this, as James says, the same with Pires.
Yeah, it's still Wenger's club, and he'll still run it in whatever way he deems appropriate, and he'll buy the players he wants. That's why the Lacazette thing is so weird as well, because, I mean, he kind of fairly vaguely likes him, but he was only willing to pay 26 million for him last summer when Leon wanted 60. So
the Pires situation is weird because he's not played terribly, but obviously Wenger doesn't like something about what he's seen in training. It's very rare for Wenger to hang out a player to dry like that in terms of selection, so don't know what's going on there.
That one was a punt. They turned him down earlier in the summer. They just thought, okay, well, we need someone. Giroud's injured. Welbeck's injured. We need a body.
But he played well.
Yeah, it's odd. It's just weird. Ultimately, Wenger was kind of never really sold on him, but, you know, almost it was like effectively a loan deal. Yeah. I mean, it will turn out to have been one, but they'll have lost a lot of money on him.
Last couple of questions on this. I've had a question from Akchowski Jr., who asked, do you think Arsenal are really interested in winning trophies or just making money?
Yeah, I think they're absolutely interested in winning trophies, because why wouldn't you? I mean, do you think Arsene Wenger, if we say this is Arsene Wenger's club, do you think Arsene Wenger isn't interested in winning trophies and interested in his legacy? I mean, just look at how he reacted to winning the FA Cup. Look how angry he gets when that question is put to him. Of course, football clubs care. Are Wenger's kind of feet placed on the fire? Were they after last season when they finished so far behind Leicester? No, but even then, they gave him £100 million to spend to kind of push them towards the title. It's such a myth that Arsenal don't want to win. They might not be ruthless, but of course they want to win trophies.
Mm. Of course he does. And also, like, from a board point of view, you win more trophies, you attract bigger players, you get more sponsorships, you make more money. So, you know, being the all-time most successful club in the FA Cup is something that you put in a sales deck. That's how the boardroom think about it. But for Arsene Wenger, that's his record. Nobody's ever beaten that. Second on this is George Ramsey. He managed Aston Villa for 42 years. Nobody's beaten that.
Steve Bruce could give it a go.
He could try. He's going to fail.
Just speaking of managers, I think if people remember the last time Wenger's future was properly under consideration, there was talk of who Pep Guardiola is going to go to next. It ended up being Man City. Some people look back at that and look as a bit of a missed opportunity. Arsenal being the perfect club, some people said, for Guardiola to come in, all the right kind of players, the right kind of philosophy, all the rest of it. Thomas Tuchel's now available this summer after losing Borussia Dortmund, another manager admired by Arsenal fans and neutrals alike. Is this another case of Wenger getting his timing slightly wrong, James?
Harsh. I love Dortmund, and I think they're a fantastic team, but has Thomas Tuchel really proven that he's a dramatic step up on Wenger?
He's not a Pep either.
Tactically,
he's fantastic. He ticks a lot of the Arsenal boxes, but they're kind of the boxes that Wenger ticks as well. Fantastic at bringing through young players. You know, teams play with real style, pace and verve. But then again, he hasn't won the Bundesliga. I know that's incredibly difficult when you're against Bayern, but
he was
Arsenal,
pretty much the best ever second place team.
Yeah, absolutely. But Arsenal don't want to be the best ever second place team, and they can't be certain. I think, you know, Guardiola is maybe amongst the sort of half dozen managers that you can be certain will represent a definitive upgrade on Wenger. And actually, I don't think there's any reason why, if timings fall in the right direction, Guardiola couldn't be tempted to go from Man City to Arsenal. I mean, it doesn't necessarily sound like he's loving his time in Man City.
Would Arsenal give him the £300 million he needs to be successful, though? Shade. Nick, just one for you. Last time Wenger won the FA Cup, he won it back-to-back. Some people said that was a missed opportunity to go out on a high.
Yeah.
We've talked about the difficulty it's going to be to win the Premier League or the Champions League, the trophies he wants to finish off his career. Is this a bit of a miscalculation again?
So this one, no, but the previous one, yes. He definitely should have left last time. It was the perfect time. And everyone was going, perfect, great squad. There's lots going on here. There's money in the bank. Like, leave it. There were loads of managers available. Like,
would you say the Pep factor is part of that?
Yeah, I think. I mean, I thought at the time that the perfect thing that Wenger should have done was step up to director of football and get Carlo Ancelotti in or something like that. That would have been unbelievable. You know, someone who's just a great coach, just is fine with being told what to do. you know, someone coming in and taking over the whole remit of what Wenger does, it's quite an undertaking.
Yeah.
But it was a perfect opportunity for a change of structure. This year, there's not a lot of top-quality coaches available. I know that Van Bronckhorst is going to Dortmund. He'd been quite interesting for Arsenal, but it would have taken him a long time to get to grips with the expectations at Arsenal. I don't think Tuchel's quite up to it in terms of... But he's definitely on his way. He's just a really good coach and tactically very interesting. But
yeah, I mean, by all accounts, well, he sounds like quite a difficult personality as well. And in a club like Arsenal, that's probably not what you want.
Yeah, there's so much to management nowadays, like in the media, the politics, you know, blah, blah. And with a fractious boardroom, like, you know, which of course Wenger is responsible for in some part, it's a huge undertaking. So I think this summer the right thing to do was for Wenger to stay. But he should... if he cares about the club as much as he says he does, think about how do I hand over this? Shall we identify a coach now that takes over in two or three seasons or whatever it might be?
Fair enough. We're going to come back to domestic matters, including Manchester City and their spending, which Manchester City fans, I was only joking about the 300 million. We will get onto that a little bit later on with more detail. But as you might have heard, this weekend, it's the Champions League final, the big showdown between Real Madrid and Juventus at Cardiff. Cardiff! What a great place to have a Champions League final. Zidane takes on Allegri. Depending on who wins, it will either be the first team to ever defend the Champions League title in the Champions League era, of course, versus the second ever treble winners in Italian football. Who is your favourite, James?
I'm sure the bookies are backing Real Madrid, but I just can't... I know I've said this all year, so I'm not going to change it. I can't see past Juventus. They've got the best defence in the competition, but there's so much more than that. You know, that attack of Pjanic... Mandzukic, Dybala and Higuain is just phenomenal.
Got everything, hasn't it?
It's got the lot. They're an absolute joy to watch. They're just a relentless winning machine. And I can't see them not winning.
I can't see past Real. the bookies weirdly have it. They have it totally evens at the moment, which I was really surprised by. I think Real, mostly because I think Juve's run to the final has been massively overhyped. I do think so. I think Real have played much tougher teams and they've been much more impressive in the knockout phases. Juve have had a bit of a coast. Porto, who, you know, didn't put up much of a fight. They had Barca, who... the shadow of the team that they previously were. PSG proved that. You know, Barcelona was so lucky to come back in that PSG game. And then that Monaco team, yeah, they're very exciting, but Juve exposed them for what they really were, as a team that's fundamentally flawed, full of great attacking talent, but can't manage a game, especially over two ties, because they're so young and inexperienced.
You kind of look at it as a precursor to what happened with United and Ajax, in a way.
Exactly. I think it's going to be a bit of a wake-up call for Juve, especially in the midfield area. They haven't played a midfield as good as Modric and Kroos and Casemiro all season. You add the whole Isco element and that midfield diamond, I just don't see Juve being able to control the game and the pace of the game, which is what they do so well, as much as they'd like to.
Nick's kind of hinted at it there, but for you, James, what are the key battles you're going to be looking out for?
I'm quite intrigued to see what happens down the Juventus right, or the Real Madrid left. Dani Alves, we're assuming it's whether or not he kind of is fearful enough of what Ronaldo can do that he stays back, because if he goes forwards, as great a fullback as Marcelo is, Dybala and Alves against him, that's what makes me think Madrid are gonna lose it.
I mean, if you want one right back to take on Marcelo and Ronaldo, exactly. It's the guy that was like, well, I did this single-handedly for Barcelona for about
three years. He'll do the lot for you. And I think that's... If Juventus can get on top on that right flank early on, I think that's where they win it. Because I also think as good as Real Madrid's centre-backs are, Higuain can get at them, dominate in the air. And if they hit to the back post, and I don't know if Mandzukic will start, but if he does, I would be pinging balls into the box and really testing those centre-backs. And that side, there's Ronaldo against the BBC, the true BBC. Yeah. I know it won't be those two, but against the centre-backs.
It's also the first, speaking of key battles, the first time BBC, you know, Barzagli, Bonucci, Chiellini, will face someone who's probably arguably better in the air than them. So they will be very nervous about that. Because crosses into the box have not been an issue for Juventus throughout this whole competition and for most of the Serie A season. Now all of a sudden they've got probably the best attacking player in the air. And it's like, oh, that's... that's a bit of an issue. I actually disagree with James on the Dani Alves point, because I think one thing that was interesting from the Atletico game was how Cruz played so far on the left against Atletico, and just basically, you know,
diagonals.
Just basically diagonals and controlled the play from that angle. It really frustrated Atletico. So I expect Dani Alves to maybe be caught out of position trying to close down Toni Kroos or trying to step off him. I think it'll catch him off guard.
I did actually have a question on Marcelo and Dani Alves, but we'll come to that in a second, because I think you just touched on something quite interesting there, which is Zidane's kind of underrated tactician abilities.
Luckiest manager ever.
Do you think does he make his own look, though? We've seen how he set up against Atletico Madrid, where he played that 4-4-1-1, and everyone was shocked by it, like, oh, Zidane's using tactics, what's going on here? Yeah. And it worked, an absolute dream. Yeah. He makes me think a little bit like of Ferguson at United, in that he doesn't bring tactics out every week going, oh, look what I'm going to do, here's my working. He keeps it for when he really needs it, and then lets his players express the rest of the time. In some ways, I'm excited to see what Zidane's going to do to try and counteract Juventus in this one.
Yeah, I think that about halfway through his first season, he started experimenting with tactics. They went on this amazing run, and then they kind of fell away. And he started experimenting with tactics, and it did not work at all. And he just sort of went to
back three and all.
Yeah, he changed the formation, and obviously, like, loads of good managers in Europe are doing that. So he thought, I'm gonna do lots of this, but it just didn't work. And he was like, right, what we need is the right mindset tactically rather than this. And what Real do better than any other team in Europe is just control the game. The example I always use is that first leg against Atletico. They went 1-0 up early, and they just bossed the ball, just bossed it, and just waited to see if they could get second. Once they got second, they were relentlessly attacking. The mindset of that club, the mindset of that team is incredible. Zidane is lucky in so much as that somehow Real Madrid have built the best squad in Europe. I don't know how they've done it. I mean, they've got an incredible, incredible team, and everyone seems pretty happy with their role except James Rodriguez. And, you know, there's a certain point where you get to these elite games and there's so many good players on the pitch that luck, there's no real luck in terms of it.
You just called him a lucky manager.
No, I was joking.
Oh, good.
I was joking. I don't think he's a lucky manager at all.
We need that sarcastic emoji just pop up.
I don't think he's the best tactically in the world, but I think in terms of installing that mindset and making players understand what you need to do when and maximising their talent, I think he's brilliant.
And he looks like he's got them, like, really physically fit as well.
I completely agree with that. I just think it's so odd with a team like Real Madrid, but there were definitely times, even under Ancelotti and in the years beforehand, where they walked out on the pitch and they didn't walk out like Real Madrid. And I think the big thing that Zidane has achieved is they walk out like they are completely aware of the fact that we are the greatest team in history.
Yeah. The Monstars of Space Jam. Yes.
They literally walk out like we are Real Madrid. Yeah. Here we are.
Like, come at us. Yeah. We are better than you. And it all starts from that. And, he's not hugely tactically sophisticated, but he's got that.
He picks his changes really well, doesn't he?
So much of it is, you know, we say world-class players can't be world-class managers, but because he's a world-class manager, he's instilled that swagger that he had in that team. Simple as that.
He is, I mean, we've said it before, but he's like a Galactico squad with an actual Galactico who's moved into the dugout now.
Yeah, management sort of covers up Zidane's flaws in certain respects, which was, like, let's be honest, his work rate was... People go on about Mesut Ozil being lazy. Zidane, if you watch him for 90 minutes, not the biggest runner in the world. And also his capacity to lose his temper. He can't do that because he's not on the pitch. So he's just maximising his skill set. All right, nobody's like the genius that he is with the ball, but he's relaying all of his skills to them, and they're not. It's not possible for his flaws to be apparent on the pitch.
If he can't give them his genius, he is giving them his composure, his kind of, you know, the game management.
Will
side
to
of
win.
It,
do you think we could get, if this works out, do you think we could get old Ronaldo as their next manager?
Oh, yes.
Or at least the shooting coach.
God. The diet would just go terrible.
It's chips for breakfast, lads.
There's a lot of love there for Zidane, but Maximilio Allegri, better than Antonio Conte? And I'm not saying that to wind up Chelsea fans. He's got Juventus into two Champions League finals now. Mm-hmm. Conte never came even close to that. He's won the Coppa Italia. Conte, again, never managed that. Obviously, he's working with the foundations that Conte put in at Juventus to turn them back into the most dominant team in Italy. But, I mean, what do you make of it? He was a manager that used to be derided for the kind of weird politics at Milan.
A much better manager than Antonio Conte. And I think Antonio Conte is fantastic, but...
That's straight up.
First of all, if we go back to... Let's just go back to before Juventus, when he kind of kept Milan competitive as they were being torn to pieces. You know,
but he bore the brunt for that, didn't
he? Exactly. Yeah. He got the grief, and look at where they are now. But you know, you say the foundations of Conte's side, and yeah, he's got them at the back. But again, he's been the one that's come in, and Pirlo's gone 1 year, Tevez has gone, Pogba's gone, Vidal's gone, and he's made them better than that. And he's made them better than that, arguably within a collection of kind of slightly inferior players. I mean, would I take Pjanic over Pogba? No. Certainly wouldn't take Pjanic over Pirlo. They don't have a striker that's as good as Tevez was then, as good as Dybala is becoming. And he's done all that. They're so flexible. How many formations have they played this year? That they started with a back three. Yeah. Suddenly they're playing a 4-2-3-1 where he's turned Mandzukic into a left-sided target man, like what we wish Thomas Muller always was.
Well, he's kind of deeper than Sandro at times, isn't he?
That's crazy.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I'm a Serie A fanboy, but to my mind, he has to be the best manager in the world right now. Has to be.
Just he's getting more out of his team than anybody else.
Yeah, he's turned them into this formidable juggernaut, and they can just change on the fly. They're brilliant, and the Alexandro as well has morphed into the best left back in the world. Dani Alves was not that good in the final years at Barcelona. He's now a phenomenal. Like he's at his peak, I'd almost claim. It's a joy to watch.
Yeah. I think Conte's a better man manager and motivator than Allegri. I think Allegri's a better manager tactically and in terms of planning out a game and in terms of like a whole cohesive squad. I think Conte's performance in the league has relied a lot on individual performances within a system that he's created. He's tactically a bit of a maniac, but you know, he did switch the system once and it worked. Allegri is even tactically superior to Conte, which is saying something into itself. But the way Conte turned Bonucci into the best ball playing centre back in the world can't be ignored. I think it's pretty close, but I do agree with James. I think Allegri is better. Is
it Allegri wouldn't have let the FA Cup final run away from him.
That's a very good point.
I don't want to be harsh, but Conte does have a habit of when a game goes wrong, he's quite bad at fixing it.
Mm. Maybe that's the emotional side of it. He doesn't have the kind of clear-headedness. But this sounds a little bit like the whole George Graham's defence, Warnock, Arsene Wenger, all his big glories, doesn't it? A little bit. Will the true test of Allegri come when he has to replace BBC?
Potentially.
But he started doing it. I mean, Barzagli is more a player off the bench now. Yeah. He's got such a great collection of young defenders, Rugani.
He's still got Buffon at the back. I mean, when they're fit, Chiellini and Bonucci are still his go-to guys, aren't they?
Yeah, but he's... Bonucci's not that old. Chiellini's the one that's, you know, really getting on. But I think the way he's brought through Alexandro hints at the fact that he can do a good job replacing them.
I must admit, I was playing devil's advocate there, and there's a kind of a hushed offence in the room.
How dare you doubt big old Max?
Back to Real Madrid, back to Ronaldo. Will he finally turn up in a Champions League final? Ooh, he's a bit of a passenger in 2014.
I'm not so worried about slagging off Conte now after he said that.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Ronaldo wasn't great in those games, but what that enabled Real Madrid to do is that. So Ronaldo had two men on him all game, maybe three.
Absolutely.
So massively helped out Carlo Ancelotti in the first final and Zidane in the second final. That is a huge thing. So basically the whole question is Ronaldo going to play on the left where he'll be faced with Dani Alves, who's not the best one-on-one defender, but very, very strong at recovery, tackling and positioning. So you'd expect him to skin him, even though Ronaldo's lost a yard of pace this year. Or is he going to play him through the middle and just try and get as many centre-backs pinned to him as possible and let Toni Kroos and Luka Modric come in with late runs?
He's kind of been at his best when he doesn't have a position. He's just allowed to roam where defenders don't want him to be. Almost like Muller-esque in a way.
Yeah, I mean, part of me thinks that Zidane will look at the job Benzema did on Godin in their knockout game and just think, I reckon Benzema could do a similar job against... Because he's a big lump, he's quicker, he causes problems with late runs, he sort of pops up everywhere.
Feet are ridiculous as well.
He's got great feet. He might be tempted to go with Benzema and just let Ronaldo be a decoy, but if he plays Ronaldo in the central striker by himself, it's literally just a ploy to attract as many bodies to him as possible to open up space for other players.
Such as Isco, maybe, who it sounds like, on form and fitness, he's going to start. With sadly Gareth Bale not going to be in the starting lineup, mainly due to injuries, as he returns to Cardiff for a Welsh hosted Champions League final.
Yeah, that's sad, but I mean, he's just a pretty good option to have off the bench, isn't he? And you know,
he has been named in the squad, by the way.
He's definitely in the squad. So, and I would, I mean, I think, you know, Nick mentioned here on Ronaldo being dangerous in the air. Well, if you've got Ronaldo and Bale on it at the same time, let's say, you know, if you happen to be chasing the game and you need to be pinging balls into the box. But yeah, huge credit to Isco. And going back to the tactics, you wonder if that kind of, if you've got that diamond, you know, with Isco at the tip of it, even though theoretically he's like the right winger, but he's basically playing in the diamond.
He's kind of everywhere.
Yeah, really. Exactly. But that's, and then you've got Benzema as your centre forward, and then you've just got Ronaldo. And you just say to Ronaldo, yeah, go where you want. That, I think that's probably the most effective tactic, even though that does, again, put pressure on Real's wing-backs or full-backs. I think that's where it will be decided.
But on that point is what I was going to get onto a bit earlier on when we were talking about them both. Full-backs and wing-backs have become more and more and more and more and more important in football all around the world recently. I mean, we're always talking about their tactical importance and all the rest of it. Given how many assists, how many chances created they have done in the Champions League this season, could this actually be a bit of like a landmark final? Could this be the Marcelo-Dani Alves Champions League final?
No. Your man on the street, like, you're absolutely right, but your man, the man on the street he will not remember the fullbacks.
No,
never.
Like, who were the fullbacks in Barcelona's side that beat Arsenal in the Champions League final? I mean, you know, but
yeah, the man on the street
Mr. Formandeo has no idea.
Steve on the street. Yeah, I mean, I mean the thing is that Marcelo and Dani Alves are two big game players as well. They always turn up in the big games. Marcelo was unbelievable against Atletico in both legs. He's been
and Bayern as well.
Bayern, he was incredible. He made like that whole right side just look ordinary.
That was
Bayern.
The game where Philip Lahm went, I should retire. That's a good point.
The interesting thing for me is on the other side. Alexandre has been incredible this season. And Dani Carvajal has been named in the squad for Real Madrid, but it might be, you know, Nacho at right back. I'd be tempted to go. Dani Carvajal has been a huge player for Real Madrid this season.
Spanish Gary Neville.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I'd be tempted to go with Nacho just for that extra defensive solidity, because Alexandro loves to bomb on. You also got to consider if
anyone's going to wrong foot anywhere, I'd probably say Nacho's the guy who's going to get his feet tangled compared
potentially, yeah, but he doesn't really cross the halfway line, to be honest with you. He really doesn't. And the other factor as well, which counts against Marcelo, is which might pin him back and affect his influence, is if Juan Cuadrado gets a start, because you don't want to leave him with some space to run into, because he is lightning.
And he's another wing-back who, I mean, for his country, he plays at wing-back.
Effectively,
so
yeah.
It's another full-back conundrum there.
Yeah, we don't really know who's gonna start for Juve. Real Madrid's team's writes itself, pretty much. The only doubt is whether it'll be Ronaldo through the middle or Ronaldo out wide with Benzema or 4-4-2.
I think we know how Juve will line up. It's whether it's a back three or back four.
Yeah. Because
they've kind of got a first 11 for both,
yeah,
haven't they?
And Zidane's going to be guessing until... you know, half an hour before.
Would you start Barzagli? Would you go back four?
I go back four. I feel like Barzagli's time has gone, and he's of the five that I'm choosing from, he feels like the one that might have a rick in him.
Yeah, I'd disagreeing again. I'd go back three, because I think
Chiellini said Barzagli is still the best one-on-one defender he's ever played with.
He's incredible, but he does. I do agree with James that he is the one that you think, oh, there's potentially a mistake there. But
he's 36.
Real Madrid are probably going to go 4-4-2 diamond, I think, with Benzema and Ronaldo up top. So I think you need the three centre-backs, because those are two very good strikers to deal with.
100%. It's going to be fascinating to see. I actually think I'm really hyped for this. I think it could be a really great game.
Is it not? I haven't been this excited about a Champions League final in ages. So long.
Last one was Real Madrid Atletico, I think, the first one.
But I mean, with that, you kind of are just a bit like, I'm just watching a La Liga game.
Yeah.
It's got to have two different countries.
Yeah.
The teams you've got to really feel are world class.
Yeah.
For me, I'm thinking it's the most excited I've been since Man United Bayern.
Yeah. Is Man United Bayern?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe Inter. But I mean, I just think that a lot of the other finals have either not had that sense of being all of Europe facing off against each other.
Because there have been
so many, like, sort of Spain on Spain.
I thought Man United
versus
Barcelona, both of them were pretty good.
Spain on Spain,
yeah.
Actually.
That's true, actually. The Man United Barca may be the first one when it really felt like it was in the balance.
Yeah, man. That was, that
people forget United went into that as favourites, and then Barca were like, nah, we've arrived.
That game was hype. That game was pure hype.
When we all said it's cool, Messi can't head a ball, we'll be fine.
It's cool. We got this.
Just let him cross it.
Britain's got this.
But I think this Champions League final between Real Madrid and Juventus, imagine if you were like writing one of those awful, reductive sitcoms. Like, imagine if you were writing
Mrs. The Big Bang Theory. Let me finish the sentence for you. Mrs. Brown Boys.
Something like Doctors, like a daytime TV show. And you want a character.
Wait, whoa.
You want a character.
Doctors is legit.
Fine, it's legit. But you want a character in the background going, oh, what are you watching, Sheila? Oh, it's only the Champions League final between Real Madrid and Juventus. That sounds like it's the kind of thing they put in because they go, oh, they're big teams. That'll sort it. It's a Doctors Champions League final, isn't it? That's a casualty, a Hollyoaks-esque kind of background. Oh, that sounds
good. Are you talking about like that time on EastEnders when I can't remember who came down and said, oh, have you heard Michael Jackson's died the next day? Because they were like, Michael Jackson's dead. We should get this in EastEnders.
Yeah.
You're reminding me of the time that on Neighbours they said Milan Jovanovic was the best player in the world.
That's the opposite because that's someone who doesn't know anything about football going, oh, that's a name. Whereas this is if you had someone in the kind of scripting going, I know a little bit about this sport, that you pick two teams that go, they sound convincing. That sounds like a good Champions League final. That's what this is. This is weird tangent.
I just can't believe you said Doctors was reductive.
I'm
it's
sorry.
The opposite of reductive.
I'm sorry. Sorry, Doctors. Sorry, Man City fans. We're getting a lot of apologies in this podcast. But one very good cup final, which you might have watched, was the FA Cup final between Arsenal and Chelsea. I said we're going to come back to it, so we're going to come back to it right now. Arsenal won 2-1, and in the most un-Arsenal of fashions, really, they came back from a Diego Costa goal within seconds to score the winner. I mean, for a team that are so often lambasted as lacking, you know, moral and mental strength and all the rest of it. It's a pretty good performance, wasn't it, Nick?
It's pretty Arsenal to win an FA Cup final under Wenger.
That is true.
Gone to 8, lost 1, which they probably shouldn't have lost because it was that Liverpool game, which was a bit of a travesty with the refereeing.
Those scars are still there.
No, Michael Owen was very good in that game, but it was much closer than the scoreline suggested. No, Arsenal win FA Cup finals. I thought that they definitely had a chance going into the game. I think what nobody expected was from the first minute was Arsenal to be so dominant and just cruise through Chelsea. As any time Xhaka got the ball, he just had a pass on to Ramsey, and they were running at the Chelsea back three. It was remarkable. Aspilicueta was, you could see he was looking around going, what the hell is going on here? Where is N'Golo Kante?
Yeah.
You know, Ozil was man of the match for me. He was unbelievable in that game.
But this new system is just, it's a dream for
me. I mean, he made Kante just like doubt his own shadow. It was an incredible performance. They just across the pitch, they just had them man for man. It was a strange game.
But where's his performance been, James? Because if they play like this week in, week out, they're going to win the title.
Yeah, but it's so Arsenal to, I mean, of course it matters, but it doesn't matter as much as winning the league title, so it's so Arsenal to pull it out then. It's kind of been there in patches since he switched to the back three. But I think some of it is that, you know what they did, and you listen to Per Mertesacker afterwards, and it sounds like they've stumbled on this great idea when Arsenal players talk about it. They actually prepared for the match. They looked at their opponents, thought, what are the weaknesses here and how do they try and play and how can we nullify that? And so we know Chelsea like to hit balls over the top of the opposition defence. So Per Mertesacker just thought, I'm tall. I could head those balls. And
revolutionary.
They also looked at Diego Costa and thought, I think there's something wrong with him. And they got inside his head. And I tell you what, though. I mean, I have to say, the highlight for me of watching that FA Cup final was the way Rob Holding and Per Mertesacker got inside Diego Costa's head. There's a moment, if you find it, look on Twitter, where Rob Holding goes up quite early in the game to Diego Costa and just goes, you're mental, you. And then moments later, Per Mertesacker comes and just like taps Diego Costa on the shoulder. He's like, it'll be all right. It'll be all right.
We'll find, we'll get you the care you need.
And he walks over to Rob Holding and high fives him. Like, I mean,
they're marking him in his mind.
It was amazing. That was something spectacular. But it's so Arsenal to only pull out this performance at random intervals.
But it was very un-Chelsea as well, because they're also another club that have a fantastic record in the FA Cup, especially in the 21st century.
Yeah.
Conte's never won a domestic cup. I don't think he's ever won a European one either. I mean, I think he won a Super Cup in
he's England. A league manager.
He is
you
a
say
league
got
manager.
Cup managers, he's a league manager.
Do you think that's going to be a problem for him in England, James?
Not if he can keep winning the Premier League, but I think yeah, it's important to show progress in. I think it'd be more of a problem in the Champions League where he was quite poor with Juventus. Like, you know, didn't even get them out of the group stage on a couple of occasions. And I don't think Chelsea fans or Roman Abramovich will settle for that. It's intriguing because he's been fantastic, but he's been fantastic over the space of sort of 45 games. So there's still a fair bit to prove. I mean, as much as anything, I just think they'd all kind of, by all accounts, he really tried to drill into them the importance of this game, but I think they were mentally on the beach a lot.
Well, he did admit he allowed them the time and the space to celebrate their league victory, and they did look maybe 75% of their usual intensity. Yeah. But speaking of percentages, in his press conference after the game, Conte said that his team had been 130% every week all season, and that he needs numbers and quality, that's a quote, in the summer to kind of keep the ball rolling. At Juventus, he was obsessed with winning the league with a bigger points tally every single year. Mm. Just how much do you think this squad needs?
A fair amount, but I think Conte needs to learn how to use his squad because he didn't do a lot of that at Juve. And he's not done a lot of that at Chelsea this season.
Do you think? I look at Conte's squad this year, and nothing was out of place. Every single player in that team
didn't
had like
he
a
use,
purpose.
Didn't he use fewer players than any other manager?
But that's what I mean, because every single one, like, he knew exactly when to bring him in.
That's not using your squad, though. That's what he should have done for the FA Cup was identify that Fabregas was the obvious player, three-man midfield, and dominate that midfield. He played a two-man midfield against someone who's incredibly lithe and runs all day in Aaron Ramsey, and Mesut Ozil, who was keeping Kante busy, and he put Matic against the more mobile Granit Xhaka, who was an excellent passer. It was an obvious tactical mismatch.
Granit Xhaka mobile?
He's more mobile than Matic.
Do you reckon?
He's more mobile than Matic.
Granit Xhaka secretly has the lot.
Yeah.
But we just wrote him off after three weeks.
He's slow, but he's surprisingly good at getting into space. Matic is, once he gets going, he's quick, but he's not exactly mobile.
No, I see what you
so
mean.
So Conte should have put on Fabregas and just bossed the midfield from the first minute. That's what he should have done. But he's not using his squad. He was like, first 11, I'll win this game. What he wasn't expecting was a dip in their performance and intensity levels from the start. David Luiz was poor. Aspilicueta wasn't great. Victor Moses didn't have a great game. You know, across the pitch, they weren't up to it. And it was sort of like, oh, I don't know what to do. He brought on Fabregas far too late in that game for me. Brought on Willian far too late. Willian got the assist for Diego Costa's goal. He's exactly the sort of player that causes Arsenal problems.
And he was so good in the semi-final.
He was so good in the semi-final.
Which is an example of when he did use his squad, I guess. So maybe just, as you say, he just went back to the default for the final. So
run through that squad. How many subs does he trust? Truly trust none.
Yeah.
Vaguely, Fabregas and Willian. So,
how long did it take him? Sorry to interrupt. How long did it take him to trust Batshuayi?
Yeah, and he doesn't, does he? I mean, I know he's thrown him on a bit, and like, but the Diego Costa replacing Diego Costa with Batshuayi, bizarre. But Batshuayi is not Conte's man, and he's either he's going to go or he's going to play in the reserves. How much does he need? He basically needs a new bench. Mm. I mean, yeah, he needs a new goalkeeper now. He's got Christensen coming back, but do I believe Chelsea are really going to give him regular run of games? Yeah. No.
He doesn't look like a manager to bring through the youth either. Those Dominic Solanke's gone, you know.
But I think that there was a little bit more to that one, though. Is that there was a long-standing contract.
There is a bit more to that, but it's been years in the making. Loftus-Cheek, I don't think he'll stay. You know, I can see him leaving. These guys...
Shalabar and Victor Moses, though.
Shalabar played four games, four league games all season.
Victor Moses is there by default. You know, there's no. I agree with James. It's totally a question of trust. As Antonio Conte looks at his bench and thinks, "Who do I trust? Oh, the World Cup winner. You know, that's an easy one. You know, oh, Willian, who's basically the best bench player in the league. You know, it's he needs players that he can trust. And fair enough, he'll probably get them. But he also needs an upgrade on Gary Cahill.
I think he wants an upgrade.
Van Dijk's been linked as well, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, Van Dijk would be great for them. You know, David Luiz has been really good. Aspilicueta's fantastic. Yeah. Their starting 11's fantastic, and I expect them to do really well in the league again next season. But it's that whole thing of challenging on all fronts. You know, you need the squad, you need to use it.
And I guess in this final, we kind of saw what a lot of the doubters of the 3-4-2-1 were kind of threatening we'd see all season. As soon as the energy levels dip, this is such a difficult formation to pull off, which is why until recently so many teams didn't try it out. Whereas Arsenal obviously have switched to this recently. We've had a question through from Ahmed Youssef who asks, what do people with more tactical insight than me think of Arsenal's 3-4-2-1? Is it actually a solution going forward?
How much tactical insight do you have?
Yeah, you're not very much. Yes, it is, because Arsenal's strengths are that their fullbacks play like wingbacks. So why not play their fullbacks as wingbacks? And their greatest weakness has been when they defend with five players. With this formation, they plus goalkeeper. With this, they defend with seven, basically, because, you know, even Ramsey, as kind of ill-disciplined as he is, he kind of acknowledges the need to get back. I think as much as anything, this formation has prompted a change of mindset from players like Ramsey, and they've really realised just how important it is they get back on defence. I would also say, and this is boringly pedantic, Arsenal against Chelsea were not playing a 3-4-2-1, that because Ramsey is so free to go so far forward, and this is still to Wenger's credit, it's a 3-3-3-1. Which, we're getting into needlessly...
Which should be the formation they play,
yeah.
Just with three central midfielders, in my opinion. That's the If I look at this Arsenal formation, I think that's the only tweak that they need, is that extra body in midfield would make them so good to watch, which could be a variation. But, I mean, Wenger did it because they lost 3-0 away to Crystal Palace, and probably one of the most embarrassing games in his tenure. And there's been a few recently, I'm sorry to say. And he needed to shore up things defensively. So he brought in the three at the back. But then you look at the squad and you think, is he going to go for it next summer? If you think of it defence-wise, putting Mertesacker, Koscielny and Mustafi in a back three works.
Mm.
You know, Xhaka and Cazorla in a midfield two works. It's very attacking.
Cazorla's probably not coming back.
Is he dead?
Yeah.
Is he dead?
All right, we'll see.
It's back in November, they're saying. But, you know, Xhaka and Ramsey, very attacking, but it works. Two free roles behind a mobile striker like Danny Welbeck, or Giroud as a hold-up man with Alexis Sanchez and Friol, it works. And then they've just got wingers for days.
It's just the amount of balance is what has impressed me. But they play in a different way to how Chelsea or Spurs play. Chelsea and Spurs seem to want to always be on the front foot, whereas Arsenal, for once, like a team that are happy to actually step back, sit deep, enjoy the task of defending.
Mm.
And as you say, those wing-backs come back as well. It almost means that even though Ramsey does come back, there is no defensive midfielder, because as soon as they break, you've got Ramsey running on, Xhaka, as you say, releasing the ball. You've got Ozil always in space. Sanchez free to do whatever he wants. You've got a striker up there as well. It's just, it's like they spring, they coil back and then spring as soon as they get the chance. I actually thought it was wonderful to watch at Wembley.
The intriguing thing about this formation is going to be what happens when Granit Xhaka gets injured, because no doubt in my mind he's the most important player in the Arsenal team right now.
Doesn't work without him.
The only one I would be interested to see is Elneny, but Elneny would need to learn to be a bit more ambitious with his passing.
Yeah. I love Elneny.
Let's get them arrows pointing towards the goal. But yeah, it would be a real challenge to pull this formation off without Xhaka, who I'm increasingly thinking is £34 million, incredibly well spent. I found a lot of the criticism of him a bit over the top.
Is the answer to backing up Xhaka Jack Wilshere?
Could be. He plays the same role. Maybe not as physical, not as good in the air, but it could be. He's definitely a good passer. But again, fitness is the issue there, and whether he can, you know, replicate any sort of form. He also likes to bomb on, so he'd need to be told to sit. One player I'm very worried about in 3-4-2-1 is Theo Walcott. There's no space for him in that team whatsoever.
Do you not think he could play one of the free roles? We're not going to get much creativity from him, but I think if he's a replacement for Sanchez, just a sort of run around, get in the box. You never were very disciplined anyway.
I think if you combine his lack of consistency, the fact that he doesn't fit into any of these positions, I do see what you mean, but also his massive wages. I mean, it just seems like a ripe opportunity to get Theo Walcott off the wage bill.
You can't sell players like this. Is the challenge Arsenal have is someone like Theo Walcott on £140,000 a week. I mean, I know West Ham looked at him last summer. But West Ham aren't, even though he's
had his best season.
Absolutely not. They're not Northern.
Have you seen Simone's Amazon? It's going to be the challenge Arsenal have a lot. I think it's why Wilshere will end up signing a new contract, because they won't be able to sell him.
Well, moving on to other transfers and contract signings. Griezmann off to United, or off entirely. As we've kind of hinted at, Atletico have had their transfer ban upheld by the European Court of Arbitration for Sport. How is it going to affect business all around Europe? Diego Costa's probably going to stay at Chelsea now, isn't he?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Well,
I wouldn't necessarily rule out the China thing, although obviously the whole China luxury tax to bring in Diego Costa has affected that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know he says he wouldn't move to China. He seemed pretty keen a few months ago.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, because obviously that's such a huge blow for United. Because,
but also City as well, they wanted to sign Lucas Hernandez, and that might be off because now Atletico can't sign a replacement for him.
Yeah, well, there are people saying that Griezmann's still got a release clause and Man United could buy him. I don't believe that. I think Griezmann will stay at Atletico because they can't buy a replacement. He loves that club. Like, he loves that club so much, and he loves Simeone.
But there were so many twists and turns in the Pogba deal. Isn't this kind of getting the same huge hype build-up and then it goes through last minute?
He's already tweeted that, pretty much implying that he's staying. It's not happening. The thing is United now, they have blank checkbook. They're back in the Champions League. They've got some, you know, they've got a base on which to build. I mean, who do they go for?
Well, they've been the messages coming out through the journalists close to the club is that they now want a proper number nine.
Lukaku?
That's one of the names linked. Belotti's another one that's been suggested. Who do you think United should go for?
I'd lean towards Lukaku. I agree entirely with Nick that I think a lot of the Griezmann thing is he's going to be so reluctant to leave Atletico in the lurch. Though I do think it would certainly have been possible to play him as your number nine, even and keep the three that Pogba needs. I think Lukaku's got to be the obvious choice there, in that you're getting a player with a Premier League track record who you can be certain basically will slot in quite quickly and be scoring goals by September. I'm not, and the other thing is I'm not really excited by any of those alternatives. Belotti's doing very well in Serie A, but
it could just be one season as well.
Could just be one season, and then the usual suspects, isn't it? Aubameyang, who looks like he's going to PSG.
Yeah.
Cavani, if Aubameyang goes to PSG,
what is he? He's like 31.
Mourinho will murder Cavani the first game he has where he misses an open goal.
Well, look what he did with Milito at Inter. Took a striker and gave him that predatory
form
of his life, didn't he?
Yeah, that was a one-off.
You can't.
We're having a one-off there.
You can't. You can't change the essence of Cavani, can you?
Yeah. The beauty of Cavani.
I'm pretty sure you can buy essence of Cavani in a bowl down a bit.
I would.
And it smells fantastic.
It would smell fantastic.
It finds space everywhere.
Furious if you bought Cavani and turned him into someone that took every chance. That's ruining Cavani.
Yeah. Lukaku's the one, because also it ticks the Ed Woodward box. Really marketable player, really young, really exciting, blah, blah, blah.
And imagine him running onto Pogba's through balls.
Yeah, he gets you 20 goals a season, even if you're in a defensive setup. He's Premier League proven. He works hard. He responds well to man management. Mourinho would manage him quite well, even though he'd cast him aside before.
He was, of course, very mature and actually quite quite professional as well, to me. Like, I know people didn't like the comments about going to another bigger club, but the way he said it wasn't in a kind of like boastful way. He was more like, this is my career. I've got it planned out. It's all
just look at how well Drogba did under Mourinho. Mm. If people are saying that Lukaku is the second coming of Drogba, which he's not.
No.
But if Lukaku's got one flaw, it's his hold-up play. I mean, who's better to learn it from?
But at the same time, I think in the same way we're talking about Xhaka and Cavani. For me, I think I've said it a few times in this podcast, Lukaku, just because he's 6'3", doesn't mean he's a target man. He's basically a giant.
Yeah, but he can learn. He can learn. He's so young.
I don't think he can. I don't think you'd want him to. Because to me, he's the guy. He's basically a giant Chicharito. And why take that away from him?
But I think with him, you could find yourself getting someone even of a Van Nistelrooy level. Mm. Just like
I feel like you just tap merchant.
Yeah, you park him in the penalty box because he's an incredible finisher. And if he's in the penalty box and the ball comes into him, at least he doesn't have to head the ball that far or with that much power.
Yeah, he can do the same job that Ibra's been doing for United this season.
But with his feet.
Loads
but
of
with
chances.
His feet.
Yeah.
Ha-ha, yeah, exactly. And just one more question on this. Omkar Parab asks, if not this year, will United ever move for Griezmann in future? I've added this bit. The perfect Mourinho player? No?
No.
I seem to hear this all the time, that there's a player linked with Man United. Oh, he's the perfect Mourinho player. Like everyone,
there is someone particularly in our office. I'm not going to name names. He's the perfect Mourinho player.
Everyone seems to say that. Every single player.
But Mourinho,
the perfect Mourinho player is, was, and forever will be Marco Materazzi.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
The totem of Mourinho just makes players Mourinho players. Well, you're either with him or you're not.
The reason why I say it is. Diego Simeone has said that Griezmann is the most complete player in the world. A words that affect because he works so hard. He tracks back. He recovers the ball. He's defensively minded.
He's incredible.
Minded.
He's a magician.
That's what he's got, both the attacking and the defensive side.
Yeah,
of the game,
I don't think he would have the Diego Simeone has let Griezmann have a free role this season, which I don't think he'd enjoy at Man United. I mean, I've always thought this. I think even though Pogba and Griezmann get along very well, Griezmann's a consummate professional, I could see it going really, really wrong at United. And I think if they sign a big marquee striker this summer, which they're probably going to, you know, Zlatan's not young. He's had like a really, really bad knee injury. Mourinho probably reckons that Rashford needs a couple more years before being his first choice striker. Then you don't really need Griezmann if you buy that marquee striker. They don't really need him. If they buy him, it would just be like, it'd be a bit redundant.
I think Nick's hit the nail on the head there. I like to think that this season, like, Mourinho's had the France Euro 2016 box set on, and just like he's just at the end of the season, he's got to the final where it's kind of definitively proven that Griezmann and Pogba just don't quite work. It's really difficult to find a way to make those
in
two
fits
work
and spurts
together. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're incredibly talented players, so you know, but you're buying yourself a Gerard Lampard debate.
Well, we were actually saying this in the
at
office.
The cost of $200 million.
That's I think
2 days ago we were having this actually discussion in the office. Yeah. We came down the other side, didn't we? We actually said that
fits and starts. So there were a couple of games in the Euros where Griezmann and Pogba worked next to each other beautifully.
Well, it's because it kind of goes back to the whole problem with what Pogba's facing in English football. Griezmann being the centre of the team meant that Pogba wasn't scoring or creating goals, but he was doing very important, more discreet, more kind of fundamental job as a deeper lying kind of build-up guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, I come back to it. I just don't think United have a Griezmann-shaped hole in their team, in their starting 11. I think other teams do. Mm. I see Arsenal having a Griezmann-shaped hole. They'll never get him. You know, I see Chelsea having a Griezmann-shaped hole. Hazard and Griezmann behind Costa, the Costa replacement
You could see Griezmann stepping into Pedro's role. You could see him replacing Sanchez.
Yeah. Yeah, you could totally see that. I don't see where Griezmann fits into this Mourinho United team. I really don't. It's going to be another reshuffle. They come up with a sort of bodge solution, and it'll be like, oh, great, we've got Antoine Griezmann. You're not getting the best out of him, though.
Unless you move to a back three, because I think that potentially frees Pogba more.
Potentially.
Basically, United do have lots of good centre-backs. And
ironically, I think if Mourinho played Wenger's 3-4-2-1, it would be perfect.
I think I was talking in the office yesterday about this. We were like, suddenly like, oh, everything fits. Yeah. Blind is your ball playing centre back ish. You know, you've got
Marcus
Valencia
Rojo on the left.
Yeah, and you've got Valencia is a right wing back. Yeah. I mean, maybe you could give Luke Shaw a chance again as your left wing back, but you've got Damian as well.
I forgot about him.
Damian's got experience playing as a wing back.
You mean the Italian Azpilicueta?
Absolutely. and then while you're waiting for Ibra to come back, you've got a front three of Mkhitaryan, Rashford, and Griezmann / Martial.
Pretty special.
Pace.
That,
if you're listening, Jose.
Just saying.
which we hope he is. We're going to move now to the wrap-up, the very end of the podcast. Just quickly, Huddersfield are in the Premier League. Another thing you probably heard.
Go on.
Through
Hooray.
The wires.
Go on, the Huddersfields.
As people may or may not know, they're one of only four teams to ever win the English top flight title 3 years in a row. The other ones are Arsenal, Man United, and Liverpool. And Huddersfield.
There you
what
go.
A chance of that, eh?
Well,
do you reckon
done.
What are their chances for getting another title next season? Doing a Leicester,
doing the three-peat.
Will Wagner get his own ring saga in there? That doesn't
if
work.
If they bring back Aaron Moore, you never know what will happen.
Yeah, I'm just glad they beat Reading. To be honest, this is going to sound really harsh, but Reading are awful to watch.
Awful. Sorry, Reading fans. Awful stadium. Not the most exciting manager. I love the club. But yeah, I'd just live without them being back.
I mean,
Huddersfield are going to make things happen next season. They're going to make things happen,
isn't it? It's so different. Like away days to Huddersfield sound cool, and they're also £100 season tickets. I wish I could get myself one of them.
As I've told Nick before, they've got great broadband as well. Really invest in the local fiber optics.
He keeps talking about the broadband.
You know, I wrote a 10,000-word... I genuinely wrote a 10,000-word feature on rural broadband provision.
Really?
I'll send it to you one day.
Well, please
it's
do.
It's quite good.
Check that one out, listeners.
I didn't always dream
of it. If you want a job as a football journalist, I think James Bench has highlighted the path to
there
success.
There you go. Commercial copywriting, it's the only way. Valverde is now taking over as manager at Barcelona, replacing Luis Enrique, probably the worst kept secret in Spanish football. Everyone knew it was going to happen. More of the same after Luis Enrique. He's probably coming from a similar background as a non-Catalan ex-Barcelona player who has done well at a more provincial Spanish club.
Yeah, it's so difficult with that squad to really do much more than what that squad does. I mean, the manager... As they proved by sacking letting Luis Enrique go after three fantastic years, like the manager is kind of a sideshow to that team. You just put that team out, hope it works well, and if it doesn't, it doesn't.
And the fans to me seem really. I'm going to upset another set of fans. Like they seem so hooked on the idea that anything that isn't Pep Guardiola and isn't this hugely tactically sophisticated, I'm going to reinvent the wheel every week type way of doing things. If it's not that, it's wrong. And I found that a bit frustrating with Luis Enrique. Maybe he's not as flamboyant in his tactics as Guardiola, but I mean the football he got them playing when they were good was pretty fantastic. And everyone's been complaining about Lamezia and all that kind of stuff. You look at Valverde's record in terms of youth in his 11 years in La Liga, he brought through 34 youth players, three per season.
Yeah, part of that is the whole Bilbao thing, to be fair. But what I'd like to see Valverde do is. Valverde's greatest achievement as Bilbao manager is his use of Iker Muniain, who's this tiny little playmaking thing.
And he was burned out as well when he arrived.
Like, and he's turned him into one of the best players in La Liga. I think that the Valverde appointment means we're going to see Messi in a similar role, much more deep-lying playmaker, which is where it's sort of been going already under Enrique. The key thing for him is, how he uses Messi, how he uses the team, as James mentioned, because a lot of it is just sending that team out. But also, he needs to strengthen that squad. Barcelona have some huge squad issues. Not so much the talent, it's a total mismatch. The players on the bench are totally different to the players that are on the pitch. You bring on Andre Gomez, what's the whole thing? Like, it's a totally different style of play suddenly. No wonder he looks so exposed. Arda Turan was a bizarre decision. A lovely player, but doesn't fit in with Barcelona at all.
It seemed to me like Luis Enrique is like, rather than keeping the ball, let's get more individual duels going on the pitch, and it didn't quite always mesh. Especially guys like Andre Gomez, just you can almost see what he's going for, but nah.
It's the same issues on the bench, isn't it? I mean, Alcacer has had a naff season. I'd like to see. I mean, you mentioned Muniain, he'd be a great option off the bench. He could be one of the latest great young Spanish projects ruined by being on the Barcelona bench.
But you want to talk about release clauses. Let's not get into Athletic Club. They do not like letting you get away with them.
Was it with Herrera where Man United had to turn up and pay it in cash?
There were two agents or something who posed as United. That was a weird story, wasn't it?
There were many episodes, and Javi Martinez had to break into the club to get into his locker after he'd signed for Bayern because he wouldn't let him in or something. It's ridiculous. Final few questions. If you were in charge of a club and had to focus your entire transfer strategy around one league, which one would it be this summer and why, James?
I'm assuming this is like, which league would I be looking to buy?
Yeah, you basically got to pick one league to buy all your players from. Because you like their tactics, their style of play, their talent, all the rest of it.
Oh, that's a really... I should have looked at that beforehand.
I think it depends if what league you're managing in.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
You're in the Premier League.
You're in the Premier League.
Okay.
Yeah. And you've got a lot of money.
Championship and League One. I just think there's a lot of really...
If you've got a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pay a lot of money to get a... if I want Scott Hogan, I'm going to probably have
Tom
to pay...
Tom Kearney
40...
five times.
No, but I mean, Tom Kearney for £13 million, which is roughly what he would cost. I'd do it. I mean, the thing is, there are some absolute busted flushes that come up from the Championship, but there are so many incredible young players there. If I've got, say, a squad where I feel confident I can stay up, I would take my money. I'd say Fulham, how much you want for Sessegnon? Charlton, how much you want for Konsa? Fulham again, how much you want for Kearney?
Reading, how much you want for Jan Kermagant?
I take a lot of the Fulham squad. There are some just brilliant young players. And then I go and get Aaron Moy from Man City.
Make it interesting, you can't say the Football League, so what are you going to say, Nick?
Bundesliga. I think if you look at how players have adapted from one league to another, I think Bundesliga to Premier League has been the easiest transition.
It's almost like a time traveller from the future's gone, come on England, this is what you could be.
Yeah, and the talent that comes from the Bundesliga always seems to be like really flexible tactically and well-coached and good, sort of good-natured and well-mannered players.
Good young lads.
Yeah, just haven't really seen like a marquee name come over from the Bundesliga.
Granit Xhaka?
Not like marquee. I'm talking like...
De Bruyne?
De Bruyne, that's a good one. Yeah, forgot about that. But that was a bit of a weird one because he was only there like 18 months, wasn't he? 2 years, was it?
Well, he went on a loan to Werder and then came back to Wolfsburg.
Yeah, so Bundesliga for me.
Can I throw another one in? Ukraine.
Ukraine?
Yeah, I think there's some real talented like Ukrainian wingers plus the Brazilian core at Shakhtar what's left of it is not loving life. I think there's some cool players in Ukraine.
Not loving life.
Bargains to be picked up on the frontier. Matt Brownycake asks, as a football fan, I find it extremely poor the lack of buzz around women's football and in turn the wages that they get compared to the men's. Who should be accountable for this?
The fans.
Yeah. Which
is horrible to say.
Yeah, no,
it does sound like, oh, we're getting rid of our accountability. But I mean, we've actually written some stuff on Squawker about women's football, and no one clicks it. And unfortunately, no
uptake whatsoever. Yeah. And if anything, like negative comments.
Oh man, the stuff you get from football fans on Twitter is just horrendous.
I was at the 2016 Women's FA Cup Finals, Arsenal versus Chelsea. We at the Standard made a huge deal out of it. Not only, you know, I don't want to, you know, it got a degree of interest for us, but a lot of that was, people coming and saying really smart, snarky things. What's so sad about it is we've got an amazing women's team.
Yeah.
I really enjoy watching them. I try and watch great. Every single game.
Football is different to the men's, but I find it really, really entertaining to watch as
well. Yeah, it is. It's a bit more direct, but I mean, also the quality there is in really exciting positions. We've got the best collection of strikers in the world.
Yeah.
The weird thing is that there is money starting to go there. Like, I mean, there've been reports that Danielle Carter at Arsenal Ladies is off, like that Man City are going to try and buy her, which never happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, American players are coming over, all that, and people still just don't care. I think
there's a lot of people. I know what people will say when they listen to this podcast. They'll say, well, there's a responsibility for media organisations like Squawker, like really well established papers, especially like the London Evening Standard, to cover these events, and they're absolutely right to say that. But I don't think what fans realize is the disparity in interest is so much wider than what they realize, which is a huge shame. And I think it's a gradual thing. It's a gradual thing. It will change. It's just going to take a lot longer than people think. Already you're struggling with, you know, you just Google Sky Sports viewing figures for football matches. They are dwindling. Young people
That's regardless of gender.
That's regardless. People don't watch football anymore. A lot of people are in it for the gossip, the transfer news.
Let's put the inverted commas up, the banter. Yeah.
Oh, Jamie Carragher tweeted Danny Simpson and then he deleted it. Did you see I took a screenshot though before that's sort of the level of interest. Women's football does not have a chance with this. Part of it is
it's a cleaner product in some ways.
It's a clean product.
Yeah.
And while I don't want to be like, oh well, it's not Squawker's fault, I mean, we're small fry compared to Sky Sports. Put it on, you know, play loads of football matches.
I mean, BBC, fair play to them, they have the women's football show.
Yeah, but it's hidden away on the website and stuff as well.
But when Match of the Day wasn't on the other night, they didn't move it from its late slot. They still had like a rerun of like Great British Bake Off on or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
but it's. I mean, partly it is that there's a responsibility to cover it, but the interest is so low compared to men's football that you're never winning that war right now. Right now, you're not winning that war. And massive shout out to all the organisations dedicated to women's football, because they know they're fighting a losing battle.
And to be fair, they're doing a great job.
They're doing
an
absolutely fantastic job of it.
We're going to move on now to the penultimate question. GingerPrince28 asks, what is the psychology behind football fans brandishing a transfer as overpriced or a bargain without any concrete return of investment?
Hang on.
Do you want to unpack that?
Yeah, let me unpack this. So I've seen the word ROI. So, my eyes have lit up.
So as in... Like,
Nick did maths.
They're saying it's. So are we talking about, like, say that people are saying, I don't know, Edison or Bernardo Silva is overpriced.
Yeah,
so
I'm guessing the Paul Pogba element with people aren't looking at the stuff off the pitch as well.
Yeah,
and
yeah
like
no.
That.
So I think what he's saying is it's just he's used the wrong word. No offense, Ginger Prince. What is the psychology behind football fans branding a transfer overpriced or a bargain without concrete return of investment? Mm-hmm. So basically, how can you call a transfer overpriced or a bargain without concrete return of investment? I totally agree with the. I mean, I'm treating your question as rhetorical, Mr. Prince. But you know, the psychology behind that is football fans are so tribal; they will try anything for one-upsmanship. Assuming that football fans, of which a lot are very, very young men in the UK, understand the concept of return of investment is a bit of a push. Those who do should consider themselves part of a select group.
But it's, I mean, and it's difficult to in terms of the money you make, say if you're Man United from buying Paul Pogba, that money is not like, you know, we've paid out that 90 million but we can see where the money from Pogba is coming. So people go, oh, well, Pogba sold that many shirts. Well, most football teams don't make money per shirt. Yeah. All of it comes from their Adidas £90 million deal. So you then end up, it's quite intangible. It's how much difference does owning a player like Paul Pogba make next time our kit deal comes up, next time our official noodle partner in Tennessee comes up. You got to have one for all 50 states.
Yeah, you do. Each different one. But also, it's kind of the argument, like, without wanting to talk to industry, like, Henry Winter goes to the Telegraph, right? Like, that's an absolute statement for the Telegraph, and it enables them to attract more talent, and they've got the best football writer in the UK. You know, agree or disagree, that's his unofficial title.
The Times, though.
Right, sorry, The Times, sorry. He went from the Telegraph to The Times. that worked well for them branding-wise. But, you know, it's the same thing, but they might be paying, you know, Henry Winter an astronomical amount of money, and they're never getting return of investment on that. But it's when you're a public-facing company, it's a very different question, because the personality, the cult of personality, is a huge thing. That's why, you know, ESPN humored Bill Simmons with Grantland for so long, and eventually it all fell apart because he just wanted to do whatever he wanted. You know, that's why Vox are now interested in investing in The Ringer, which was his next project, because Bill Simmons is an unbelievable podcaster, broadcaster, and journalist with regards to basketball and American football.
But he's also a celebrity in his own right, isn't he?
He's a celebrity in his own right. The cult of celebrity, which is such a modern phenomenon, means that, yes, you will get transfers like Paul Pogba, where the ROI isn't as tangible. But you will also get transfers like, you know, what Monaco are doing with their model is, you know, buy Bernardo Silva for pennies, sell him off for $53 million. By the way, if we were calculating yesterday, if all of Monaco's transfers come off this summer with the fees that are being reputed, they're going to, like, pay off all of their debt in one summer, $153 million.
There's so many different ways of kind of running that transfer market, and where you kind of see the money being made down the line. I mean, you know, the other one is Chelsea, who basically just are like, yeah, we've got a football team, and then we've just got this side operation where we loan players for a while and then sell them again for 10 times the price we paid.
Only going off there. Yeah, yeah. He's and also rubbish. Begovic as well. I mean, okay, they've had to pay wages and stuff, but they've sold him for £2 million more than they bought him.
Mm. Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's not exactly...
it's a transfer market there.
Yeah, but just final question from Mr. Walker Porter, who asked a question on last week's pod as well. He asked about the demise of BT's European football show. Lots of sad shakes of the head in the room already. He asked a question. I wanted to tweak it slightly, so sorry.
No, don't tweak his question.
No, just widen it a bit more, because BT specific. I thought it'd be interesting to spread it out a bit more. What do channels need to do to keep coverage deep, interesting, and keep viewers tuning in, do we think? As we've already talked about, viewing figures for matches are worried about it. So how do you bring almost like this more kind of, I don't know, engaged way of looking at football that isn't just, oh, at the end of the day, lads, and all that kind of cliche?
For me, the European football show was a great product that wasn't marketed properly. I don't want to comment too much on, you know, BT Sport or anything. They're a fantastic product. You can tell they're still getting to grips with like all the television coverage. I think some of their initiatives have absolutely nailed it. For example, the almost regular availability of the Champions League and Europa League final free on YouTube is a masterstroke. I do think that the European football show, like, there is a struggle to market that, but more, that's part of the problem. I think more widely, we go back to women's football. What chance does women's football have when great shows like the European football show are getting cancelled every year? You know, the drumming up the interest is so tough. It's so tough. And like, all four of them have big social media followings. They're big names, especially Rafa Honningstein. James Richardson is a legend for anyone, you know, between the ages of 20 and 50, who's a UK football fan. It's a really tough sell. I mean, I was actually surprised to hear that it was being cancelled. I assumed the ratings were much, much better than they were. So yeah, very, very sad to hear.
But, I mean, again, what we forget being in the bubble, which we all are, and most of the people we talk to on Twitter are, and basically a lot of people on Twitter are inherently in the bubble anyway, because that's what Twitter is. Most people aren't on it. It's a cult TV show. It's a cult TV show like Firefly is a cult TV show. And
they're going to get a movie version. Is that the...
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. But generally, this is just what happens to those sort of TV shows. I'm it's really sad, but I also kind of think to myself, I love the European football show. How often did I watch it?
Yeah.
The problem is it's BT, and as you say, they're still fighting for that audience and to build.
They're not in people's habits yet, are they? That's
yeah,
the problem.
It's not, and it's on Sunday at kind of. You know, kind of between 7:30 and
yeah, it's
an
a bit
awkward
of an awkward time. Yeah,
you know, your brain, yeah, it's after all the main footballers stopped, and suddenly your brain is like, "Oh, Line of Duty's on soon."
I think I realise I didn't answer your question, which is what do these broadcasters need to make to make it more interesting?
Get James Benj on the podcast.
Podcast, guys, because he'll kill it, right? But also, I think the next time there's a deal for the TV rights, Sky and BT just have to say, we want pay-per-view online for Premier League games. They just have to say it, because that is the one thing holding people back, is do you want to pay? Like, they're losing money on subscriptions, Sky and BT now. The last TV deal sealed it. They're losing money per subscription, so, and they'd have to get like a buttload more to be able to get it. So they need to make it, if it's for the 3 p.m. kickoff, so be it. It needs to be pay-per-view. Like, why have we got Sky Box Office for boxing matches? We've not got that for Premier League. Why is it easier to watch Premier League games in America than it is in the UK? If you're looking at that UK audience, that European audience, that really valuable audience, pay-per-view. Give me an app where I can log in, deposit 50 quid for the season, and then just pay per game or pay per half for the games that I want. They've got to push for that with the Premier League rights managers.
I think I'm happy to talk about this at length, and I'd quite like to. The Premier League are
get ready.
The Premier League are mad to not do this, because they are now one of the top three global leagues, and the other two, they make this available, and it's so easy. I am an NBA obsessive, and I have the Game Pass app.
It's so good.
Very kindly given to me by the guys at the NBA. Thank you. and I obviously right now we're in the finals, but during the regular season, I can flick between any game whenever they're on. Within 20 minutes, I can rewatch the game. The highlights are so easily available. The other thing here is, you know, there was a big promise from Sky, we'll start tweeting out goals. But you get this, there's this whole world now of people putting stuff on the legal side of it, putting stuff on Twitter and social media that then flags up with you can't watch this in your country. Right. There couldn't be a better advertisement for illegal streaming than we won't let you watch this in your country.
Why do you think illegal streaming is so popular? It's because the product isn't good enough. The Premier League, the BT.
And I mean, you look at Spotify and how that's basically...
That's exactly.
You
know.
Focus on your product. And if they say like, oh, well, it's really difficult to get the right... It's not. The US, NBC have managed to get the rights sorted.
I mean, you want another example? WWE, they've got the whole WWE universe thing now. That's it's more than just highlights.
Yeah,
in fairness,
like that's more of a controlled ecosystem, which is entirely planned around.
But why couldn't the Premier League do that?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's a purely a technological thing, and people are watching crappy streams every week because there's not the availability. And also another thing, the BT Sport app is absolutely incredible. Yeah. I don't know if you ever used it. It's an amazing piece of tech.
It really is.
And I don't see it advertised enough.
No,
you know, this is the thing: is the pay per stream, just do it.
Well, I mean, hopefully people aren't paying to listen to this because we've massively overshot on our time. And
have
they,
we?
You know,
Sorry.
So I mean, that was the wrap up, which has wrapped on. But thank you very much for listening. That is literally all we've got time for. We've given you a bonus round there. But James Benj from the London Evening Standard, thank you for coming on.
Always a pleasure. You guys always seem to overrun when I'm on.
Because it's great company, great chat.
Get James Benj on your podcast.
100%. Nick English as well from Squawker. You're not going anywhere, are you? You're staying here for the rest of the day.
I'm not. I'm here for the rest of the day.
Wonderful. As am I. I've been your host, Greg Johnson. Join us again next week for some post-Champions League chat and much, much more. Thank you and goodbye.